Right, I'm starting us off at Hebrews chapter 11, verses 1 to 10, and that's on page 1209. Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. By faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. By faith, Abel offered God a better sacrifice than Cain did. By faith, he was commended as a righteous man when God spoke well of his offering. And by faith, he still speaks, even though he is dead. By faith, Enoch was taken from this life so that he did not experience death. He could not be found because God had taken him away. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. By faith, Noah, when warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear, built an ark to save his family. By his faith, he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God.
Well, continuing from verse 11. By faith, Abraham, even though he was past age and Sarah herself was barren, was enabled to become a father because he considered him faithful who had made the promise. And so from this one man, and he as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sand on the seashore. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, and they admitted that they were aliens and strangers on earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had received the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, "It is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned." Abraham reasoned that God could raise the dead, and figuratively speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau in regard to their future.
By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions about his bones. By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born, because they saw he was no ordinary child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be ill-treated along with the people of God, rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith he left Egypt. Not fearing the king's anger, he persevered because he saw him who is invisible. By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel. By faith the people passed through the Red Sea as on dry land, but when the Egyptians tried to do so, they were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell after the people had marched around them for 7 days.
By faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. And what more shall I say? I do not have time to tell you about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, and David, and Samuel, and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, and who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. Women received back their dead, raised to life again. There were others who were tortured, refusing to be released so that they might gain an even better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging, and even chains and imprisonment. They were put to death by stoning. They were sawed in two. They were killed by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains, living in caves and holes in the ground. These were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised, since God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect. Amen.
Well, afternoon, everyone. I hope you're well. So by now you've probably realised that we're starting a new series today. So we're going to be delving into chapter 11 of Hebrews, that famous chapter, as we've said, the heroes of faith, the great cloud of witnesses. But you're going to have to wait for that. Okay, there's no heroes today. I've been given verses 1 to 3 by Phil as a bit of scene setting for the whole thing. And if you look at chapter 11 and 1 to 3, there's nobody mentioned. So for the next 20 minutes or so, we're going to be looking at faith, really. What is faith? What does it mean? So, I mean, clearly faith is an important part of Christianity. And if I can quickly sneak into next week's passage, we learn from verse 6 of Hebrews 11, don't we, that without faith, it's impossible to please God. Alistair Begg says, and I think we have this quote up somewhere, there is no Christian life without faith. There may be an attempt at a Christian lifestyle. There may be an observance of religious practice. But there is no valid, real Christian experience without faith. And elsewhere, he states, faith is the indispensable channel of salvation. It is faith that is the corridor down which we walk into the experience of what it means to be truly a Christian. And I'm sure you could probably think of others, you could probably find other quotes just to emphasize, you know, what we perhaps already know. Faith is important. So if it's important, then I feel it's important we know what it is, yeah? So before this afternoon, if I'd asked you the question, what is faith? What do you think you would have answered? Now, I suspect some of you might have gone to what we've just heard, Hebrews 11, verse 1, and you might have quoted that verse back to me. You might have quoted it from the old King James Version, and we'll come a little bit back to that later. Or you might have just had some definition that included the word trust. And that word trust comes into the definition of faith that I found. I did an online search, basically. And their faith was defined as complete trust or confidence in something, in someone or something. So complete trust or confidence in someone or something. Which seemed okay to me. And then I actually went to the bookshelf and took on an actual physical book, an actual dictionary off the shelf. And the first definition I came across was faith listed as a strong or unshakable belief in something. So that was going okay. And then there was a bit of a sting in the tail, especially without proof. So that didn't quite seem so positive. And I suppose I think we need to acknowledge that, faith is used in a variety of different ways in everyday life. So you may hear things like this. So you might say that you have faith when you go on an aeroplane. And in that case, you're putting your trust in a whole range of things, aren't you? That the technicians and the engineers have built the thing well. The designers knew what they were doing when they were designing it, and that design is sound. That the pilot knows how to fly, and in particular land the thing. And if that plane and that route has happened many times, all that trust is summed up in a high probability that you'll get from A to B safely, and hopefully on time. Alternatively, faith may be portrayed as a leap into the unknown. That expression, you sort of, I took a leap of faith and I did so and so and so and so, whatever so and so and so and so is. So and so is. And there, what's faith trusting in? Well, it's maybe a range of things, but some notion that in the end, everything's going to turn out all right. And there, there probably is confidence without proof, or trust without proof. And of course, opponents of Christianity portray faith in a very negative light and take fun in doing so, really mocking Christians or Christianity. John Stott points out three. Nietzsche: faith means not wanting to know what's true. Bertrand Russell: faith is a conviction that cannot be shaken by contrary evidence. And thirdly, H.L. Mencken, he was the sage of Baltimore, 1800s writer, and undoubtedly a witty chap, but faith may be defined briefly as an illogical belief in the occurrence of the improbable. Now, why am I giving prominence to such quotes? Especially when those sort of philosophies, you know, allowed the rise of the Nazis and things like that. Well, firstly, I think sometimes it's helpful when working out what something is to know what it's not. So that's part of it. But secondly, I think these ideas around faith is somehow a synonym for credulity, for putting your mental faculties aside and embracing superstition or wishful thinking, I think they're still commonplace in the way that people think about faith. But let's be clear, and I'm quoting John Stott again, nowhere in the Bible do you find faith and reason set against one another. Faith and sight, yes, but not faith and reason. And you can read in Psalm 9:10, I think we have again after this on the slide, those who know your name trust in you. The name of God, the names of God represent his character. By knowing a name, you know that aspect of his character. You know something about him. And so if we think about reasonableness, let's think about the reasonableness of faith or trust. That depends on what you're putting your trust in. So let me give you a little example. You could put your trust in me to teach yourself or your son or daughter to play the piano. And on the face of it, that might seem very reasonable. Because even right now, there's probably somewhere, someone, putting their trust in some other human to teach another human an musical instrument. Yeah? That's all very normal. But if you knew me, or knew something about me, you would know that I have very little musical ability and don't know how to play the piano. I wouldn't know where to start. So you'd be much better asking Phil, Lisa, Wynne, Alison, apologies if I've missed anyone out that's a good pianist here, but someone who can actually play, yeah? You'd be much better asking them. But you see my point. The reasonableness lies in the character of the object or the person that you're putting your trust in. So in my example, the person's ability to play the piano and teach. In Christian faith, the reasonableness of our faith is the character and attributes of God. It's the trustworthiness of God. So you need to know something about God. And so in what I'm saying, we're not throwing away our thinking. Quite the opposite, actually. we're using our brains and our experience to make a judgment in whether what or who we put our trust in is reasonable or not. And so we're encouraged to know his character, God's character, his traits. And what might be ridiculous or foolish to trust a person to do may well be perfectly reasonable to expect an all-knowing and all-powerful God to do. So that's my general background. I'm finished through that, you'll be pleased to know. What about our actual verses? So we come to our verses today. Well, first of all, I'll say that they're not there, I don't think, as a comprehensive definition of faith. Just as I say, God is love doesn't fully describe God, but it's a good place to start. Verse 1 here doesn't fully describe faith, but it's a good place to start. And it does point out two areas where we are to put our trust in God. The future, or things we hope for, and the things we cannot see. So the future are the things we hope for, and the things we cannot see. So in the Bible, there are a number of promises that relate to the future. For example, the second coming of Christ, the new heaven and the new earth. We live in the present, don't we? That's how we're built. That's how we interact with our environment. We know the future's coming, but apart from possibly a few immediate things, we can't predict it. Even the weather forecast is unpredictable, for goodness sake. And of course, the further ahead you go, the less predictable it comes and the less accurate you can be, or less reliable you are in what you're doing. So if we want to know the future, we have to rely on something other than ourselves. And similarly, we rely on our senses, don't we, to interpret the world around us. And because we live in a scientific age, we're very distrustful of things that don't rely on things we cannot see, touch, measure. But again, the Bible tells us about spiritualities that cannot be seen or touched. God's not visible. You can't see heaven. Pick it up on verse 3. We weren't there to witness the creation of the universe. And you want to know a bit more about that? Well, that's faith, isn't it? It opens up a deeper understanding that is beyond the senses. And so we read in verse 3, don't we? What is seen was not made out of what was visible. So faith expands our horizons. And if we're thinking about our series, you know, confidence in the things unseen, the two elements there may be the future, which we can't see, so that's unseen, and the unseen spiritual realities. And the other sort of obvious thing here is we need to know what those promises are. We need to know what's written in here that God has said is promised, whether that's in future, whether that's now, whether that's about spiritual realities. So it's faith that gives us this confidence in these things. And at this point, I should probably deal with something about verse 4. Verse 1, we're not even in verse 4. So I'm going to be able to put my glasses on as well. That might help me get my numbers right. Right, okay. So the NIV renders verse 1, and I think we have this here. Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. Those of you brought up with the King James might be more familiar with the words, now faith is a substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. So the newer translations go for a subjective attitude towards the promises of God, being sure or being certain. The King James and other translations, the object reality, so the substance, the evidence of spiritual realities. Now, the difference between these two is not due to any new archaeological finds, but really, rather than when you translate some words that have a rich meaning, they might not have a direct translation to the language you're going to, in this case English, in which case your translator makes a decision as to which aspect to focus on. Now, if this sort of difference bothers you, the good news is that both interpretations can be and are true. If we just put up the next slide, please, Duncan. Richard Phillips is a New Testament commentator. He summarizes, if I can speak, like this. Faith as the substance of things hoped for is the foundation upon which they are brought into being. It's a confident attitude towards those things God has promised, and it is the guarantee that gives us a sure possession even now. That's maybe a bit long-winded. I found an even snappier one, which I like a bit better. So this is the next slide. Someone else has said, I don't know who it was, faith is about having a present posture of certainty based on the substance of what God says is real and true and will one day most certainly come to pass. I think that bears repeating. Faith is about having a present posture of a certainty based on the substance of what God says is real and true and will one day most certainly come to pass. So to summarise where we are now, the reasonableness of faith is reliant on the trustworthiness of God, and it deals with spiritual realities and our responses to them. But up until now, what I've largely been talking about is knowledge, whether that's intellectual knowledge or relational knowledge. When it says in verse 2 that the ancients were commended for their faith, I don't think the author had in mind a series of, you know, theological achievements or understanding. Faith is more than just intellectual assent. It needs to be put into practice. Again, let me give you a simple example from my life. Some of the best days I had hill walking in the Grampians were those days when I set off in the car and it was cloudy, perhaps even raining. But the forecast was for it to fare up, and it did. I understood the forecast, and from previous experience, I knew that, you know, over that time scale of 12 hours, there was a fighting chance it could be accurate. And in fact, it was actually, it was a mountain forecast, that, you know, because safety is involved, it actually was pretty good. But in order to benefit from that knowledge, from that understanding, I had to put it in action. In a sense, I had to put my faith in the forecast and actually head out for the hill. So faith is also about action. And although I've spent a lot of time on the background, the definition and the definition, trying to get us to understand it, I think chapter 11 is less about defining faith and more about showing what it is in action. The different ways it can manifest itself. And it can be helpful, I think, just to sometimes consider where what you're looking at sits within the letter or the book or whatever. So let's just think about where this sits in the letter to the Hebrews. So if you'll indulge me a bit, I'm just going to actually read from verse 10 and chapter 32. Verse 32 even. And it says, remember those, I don't know what it is in the church Bible, but so chapter 10, verse 32. Remember those earlier days after you had received the light, when you stood your ground in a great contest in the face of suffering. Sometimes you were publicly exposed to insult and persecution. At other times you stood side by side with those who were so treated. You sympathised with those in prison and joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property because you knew that you yourselves had a better and lasting possessions. So do not throw away your confidence. It will be richly rewarded. You need to persevere so that when you have done the will of God, you will receive what he has promised. For in just a very little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay, but my righteous one will live by faith. And if he shrinks back, I will not be pleased with him. But we are not those of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who believe and are saved. Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. So these Hebrew Christians, they were facing real hardship and had faced real hardship. They were suffering, They'd faced insult, persecution, prison, confiscation of property. And initially, they'd faced those trials with joy. But now they were thinking of giving up. And so the author is encouraging them to stand firm. Don't give up, he's saying, you know, don't throw away your confidence in the promises of God. Don't shrink back. Exercise faith. Christ is coming. Have a hope in the future. Now, the author could have gone, you know, as been pointed out, just could have someone pointed out that straight to chapter 12. Yeah, he could have just gone on to the themes of fix your eyes on Jesus, throw away the sin that entangles, persevere. But instead, he chooses to devote quite a bit of time, quite a bit of papyrus, a whole chapter in our structuring, to these witnesses. You know, and he goes through the Bible, starting at Genesis, and he gets as far as Rahab with the descriptions. And for me, it begs the question, why? Why would the author do that? There must be a purpose. What is it? And I can only speculate here, but I think part of it is to show the variety of how faith may be worked out. And all the characters you're going to come across, will come across in the next few weeks, they all showed faith, but in different circumstances and in different ways. And I think he's pointing us to these heroes, the Hebrew Christians, to encourage them. And his argument may have gone something like this. If those ancients, those believers in the Old Testament, if they could wait in faith, hope and endurance with their limited understanding, how much more can we, who have the fuller revelation of the promised Jesus and all he brings, how much more can we wait on the promises of God? Let me close with a quote from Chris Wright, who preaches at All Souls. And I think we have this one. And he's describing ongoing faith is what he's saying. Ongoing faith demonstrates itself, proves itself in actions, choices, decisions and behaviours based on the assumption that what God says will happen, and says, I will live in accordance with that. In other words, faith produces conduct which points to the reality of what is not yet seen. And that would seem to me a good thoughts to have in the back of our minds as we go on into chapter 11 and consider the heroes of faith, their stances, their actions in the coming weeks. So let me pray as we finish there. Lord, we thank you for your word, and we thank you for the example of those who have gone before us. May we put our trust in you and demonstrate this by our actions, our choices, our decisions, as we live out our lives. In Jesus' name. Amen.